Mr. Doug Fry, Reel 8. Now, we've got to the next point, which is your final raid we're coming up to really, which is the raid made on the 30th of July on on Ramstein?
Remscheid, R-E-M-S-C-H, likewise in the Ruhr.
And now, this is an interesting story for us, because not only does it have that, but it was actually filmed as part of this film, The Bite a Bit. We accidentally started that earlier, but partly my fault, and we both misunderstood where we're up to.
Yes.
But now we are on this. Yes. But I'd like you to take us through the full story of this mission, but particularly with regard to the filming of The Bite a Bit, which is a rather well-known film.
Yes. Right. We go down to briefing on the morning of the 30th of July, 1943, to the crew room, rather, and the battle order was up, and there were 12 crews on it, including us. We were a bit surprised, really, because having done four raids in the previous five nights or thereabouts, and we thought we'd be stood down, but we weren't. We were on it, so that was that. So off we go to the briefing at the usual time, around about 8 o'clock, and we saw the red tape going to Remscheid. Never heard of the place called Remscheid at all.
Now, how do you spell that? Sorry,
R E M S S H. Remscheid, I believe. Remscheid, yes.
So you saw this on the board?
Yep. So Remscheid, where's the Remscheid? Well, we could see it was in the Ruhr, but never heard of it. So apparently there were factories there making engine blocks, air engine blocks and so on. And also a secondary part of there was also another town next to it, Solingen, which was the German equivalent of Sheffield, a lot of steel makers there. So that was part of the target, Solingen. One half the force went to Remscheid, and then the markers were dropped on Solingen for the next half of the raid, as it were.
Now, how did you feel about this raid? Because you'd just come back from one, hadn't you?
Yes. Well, as I say, we were a bit miffed about that. We thought we'd have a step, we'd be stood down for that night. But nevertheless, it wasn't the maximum effort. There was only 12 of us on, and I think there was about just over 250 aircraft on, according to the briefing. So that was that. We were given the usual information about weather and what markers and so on, and the fact that they
now
were...
Now, hang on, because when you went to the briefing, there was something special about that briefing.
Right, when we went into the briefing hut, there were Klieg lights on and a cameraman, so we then assumed that now this film was taking place, being made.
And this film was The Bite a Bit.
We knew was going to be called The Bite a Bit, because that's what Churchill has suggested it should be. It was his suggestion that it be made in order to let the British public know what Bomber Command was doing, and he also suggested The Bite a Bit for obvious reasons. Previously, Butch Harris had been down to the squadron and told us all this.
Now tell us about his visit, because he's quite a character. This is Arthur Harris.
Arthur Harris, Air Marshal Arthur Harris.
Now, what impression has he made on you?
One afternoon, we were all told to go along to the briefing room. This was two or three weeks previously, and we didn't know why, because the battle order wasn't up, and we all bowled into the briefing room, and there was old Butch Harris standing there. He wasn't standing on the platform, he was just one side, and he told us that things were going well with Bomber Command, and that we were going to do the Hamburg raids, Operation Gomorrah, and he also told us that the Home Defence people had now cleared the window, the use of window, because they thought that the German Luftwaffe couldn't mount any sort of raid on us, so it wouldn't be needed for Home Defence, so we were cleared to use it. So Bomber Harris said, right, we're going to do Hamburg until it's no longer any use to the Germans, and we're going to use window for the first time. And also he then said, Churchill wants this film, a film being made about Bomber Command for the benefit of the British public, and he wants it called the Bite a Bit. So that was that. So when we went into our briefing for the Remscheid raid, there they were. They filmed a bit of the briefing. We were briefed in the normal way. We came out of the briefing, picked our kit up in the A-flight hangar, came out of A-flight hangar, and we were all milling around. And I didn't know at the time, but there was another camera up on one of the buildings filming down, all us milling around. And then we gradually separated into our own crews. And whilst we were, I was waiting there with my skipper and a couple of the other chaps, we looked across and there was a cameraman about 6 feet away filming us in close up. And yours truly was in about a 10-second shot. So that was that. The crew bus came, took us out to our aircraft, and off we went.
Now that's the end of the filming as far as you were concerned, but I think just to keep it in place, tell us about how people saw this later on. Because, I mean, just we'll go through that story now, if you don't mind, because we might forget otherwise.
Right. Now, having been, having gone missing that night, which we'll refer to later, I suppose, somebody stopped one of my sisters in the street and said they'd seen me at the cinema, the local cinema, called the Carlton, in fact. So she said, no, my brother's missing, and it couldn't be him. She said, oh, yes, it was. I know you're Dougie. So obviously she told my mother, and she went to the cinema. She used to go to the cinema once a week. It was a matter of routine, the local. And there it was. So when they showed this film, it's only about 12 minutes, shown between the main features, the usual thing, wartime thing. And so she threw a faint, and she was taken into the manager's office and given a glass of water and so on. And he asked her one or two questions about it. And he said, well, a lot of people think they've seen their sons and so on screen, but they don't turn out to be true. But she said, yes, that was my son, I know him. So he said, all right. So he made arrangements for her to go to the Ministry of Information cinema in Wardour Street and for a private showing. So she bowled along there, and they received her quite courteously and gave her a showing and told her when the film came to me to yell out and they would stop it. So she did that and threw a feint again, and that was that. And they gave her some stills. They sent her some glass plate stills of the film, and so that was it. And I was still missing at that time, so she didn't know what had happened to me.
So that finishes that. And now let's get back. So you've got in your crew bus off to your aircraft. Now you're not filmed in this bit. It's just in the crew bus. Before you got in the crew bus.
Yes. Yeah.
So what happened when you get? I mean, so you get in your aircraft.
Yep. It's our usual drill, really, which was really that part is really routine, because we all do the same things every night, checking everything out and so on and so forth. And me doing my routine with cleaning the guns and everything after our air test. So it's only a short trip really to the Ruhr, and so we got there uneventful, just a few desultory searchlights, the usual thing as we cross the enemy coast, a bit of flak twinkling in the sky here and there, when chaps off course going over a town. We arrived at the target in the normal way.
Anything special about the bombing?
No. We were second away that night, since it was only a small force. But already the fires were well underway. And so we're on our usual bombing run. But on the bombing run, a master beam, which I said previously was obvious because of its colour and density, I was searching the starboard side at that particular time, and this searchlight swung across, flicked across our starboard wingtip. I immediately reported it to the skipper, as was my dues, and it immediately came back and locked onto us. So, right, we were the chosen one that night, obviously, for that particular time. And immediately about seven or eight or maybe more other lights coned us. That was it. So we were now in a cone. We were on our bombing run and we were straight and level. And the flak started to come up straight away into the apex of the cone. And they were hitting us straight away. The shells were bursting closer. They were hitting us. It was very, very good shooting. As I said, they were very good and sophisticated, the defences, by this time.
Where was the aircraft being hit?
We were hit, first of all, I didn't know. We were on a bombing run, and we dropped the bombs. The skipper said, let's get our picture. And as he said that, I heard Sid's voice. So bomb's gone, let's get out of here. The skipper said, wait a minute, let's get our picture. I heard a different sound in my earphones over and above the sound of the engines. And when I looked down, you could look down because the bottom of the turret was sort of empty, if you like a sort of skeleton structure. And there were flames roaring past on the port side. And they'd started just behind the wireless operator. And they'd already burnt through. There was a bulkhead there. And my K-type dinghy was hanging on there. We all had an individual K-type dinghy. Mine was hanging on that bulkhead. And the flames had already burnt through there. So we were hit there. And the thing is, Bill Wells, where the fire started behind him, he hadn't moved to do anything about it. So I've always assumed that he'd been hit by that burst that had put us on fire. So I thought, well, there's not going to be any fighters coming in after us with all this flak coming up. So therefore, I was a bit redundant at that particular time.
So this fire was to the rear of the aircraft?
No, it was just forward of where my turret.
Just forward of you?
On the port side.
Right,
yeah,
sorry,
yes.
I'm misunderstanding.
And the street, and the flames were already, they weren't coming into the fuselage, they were sort of flat against the fuselage, like that, roaring through. So I thought I'd get down out of the turret, see if I could do something about it. Well, as I stepped down from the turret, there was a burst immediately behind us, and I felt this thump in the stomach that nearly knocked me over. And I'd obviously been hit with this shell burst at the back. And at that time, I had one foot still on the ladder from the turret, and I was still hanging on to the ladder, so it didn't knock me over. If I hadn't been hanging on, it would have knocked me. The fault of it would have knocked me over. As it was, at that almost immediately there was an enormous bang up front, and that was as near a direct hit as you're going to possibly get. And we went straight down into almost a vertical dive, and I was immediately shot up with force of gravity and stuck to the roof of the aircraft. The top of the fuselage. So I was quite helpless there. So I thought, this is it. There's no way I'm going to get out of this. But incredibly, the skipper, they must have all been either killed outright or badly wounded up the front, but the skipper pulled it out. It must have been the skipper that pulled it out of the dive. And I immediately dropped to the floor of the aircraft again.
Now, how badly wounded were you? Or did you know what had happened to you?
I knew I'd been hit, and I was going fuzzy by now.
In the stomach?
Here. So I knew there was something going on, and as I, when I thought, well, I've got my, I was lying on the floor of the aircraft with the flame streaming past me, and Dick Richards, our flight engineer, went past, saw him go past, and he opened the rear escape hatch and cleared off. So he'd gone, I still have some of my wits about me, and I thought, well, I'll make an attempt to get out again. So I went to get to my parachute, which was on the starboard side, in a rack on the starboard side, and it had gone. It was kept in with a bungee strap, and that had broken or come unhooked in the dive when we dived, and it was gone. So I thought, well, that's it again. But I still didn't give up. So I searched around and I found it. It slipped down, and I crawled along and I got it. And I sat on the step, which was formed by the bulkhead, and I was sitting on there fiddling about. I took my flying helmet off, which was the thing to do.
Why?
Well, because we were told this right at the very beginning when we joined the squadron, if you have about that, because the wire, your intercom wire, could get caught up and wrapped around your throat and strangle as you went out. So it was a safety precaution, really.
Now, what state was the aircraft in at this point? Was it still flying on the level?
It was slightly nose down, but as far as I can recall, all four engines were still going, sounded quite strong.
What about the fire?
The fire was blazing merrily away and still sort of sucked close to the wall at the side of the fuselage. And it was obviously still, it was burning through the metal by now. And yet although I was so close to it, I didn't get a scorch mark on me, strangely enough, which was rather weird. Anyway,
What about the rest of the crew, or any crew you can identify? Now, one's bailed out.
I knew it was Dick. He'd gone. Now, he missed that blast up front because he was putting a window out. He was behind the bulkhead putting a window out. So he missed that blast, so he got away without a scratch. He went. He'd gone.
Shouldn't he have helped you?
Well, later, he told. I met him later. And he...
Well, it was a very fraught. I'm not criticising.
No, 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 no.
Sorry,
no,
I didn't mean that. But no. Perhaps I wondered whether you might
no,
have.
No, he would. Yeah, he would have done. But there were circumstances.
We'll talk about
circumstances.
Yeah. What about the others?
So the four up front, I didn't see them, and till I regret. I wished I'd been able to go up front and see if I could have helped them, but I couldn't. So there was nothing
because of the fire or because of the way you were.
The way I was. Yeah. So I didn't. Although common sense told me that burst had done something very badly out the front for us to have gone straight down like that, and also that my skipper somehow or other pulled it out. Subsequently, events of course proved me right in that I knew that they were killed, but. So that was it. I'm trying to put on my parachute, and I saw my rear gunner come out of the turret at the back, and he looked as though he was miles away. He looked like a midget. It was a very strange, peculiar thing, really. And I learnt later that he did, in fact, help me on with my parachute. He told me later.
But you didn't know what was happening?
Not at the time, though. No.
Were you passing in and out of consciousness?
Yes, yes. I was airy-fairy, if you like. So my parachute's on, and my sort of instinct took over, and I went out. Ken had already gone. I saw him go. So that was those two gone, the flight engineer and the rear gunner, and I was the third one out, third and last one out. So I went.
But you went under your own steam? You weren't pushed out?
No. Ken did that, and then he went. And then I went up to the rear exit, which of course was open, and off I went. My parachute opened immediately. I have no recollection of pulling the ripcord. I think the slipstream just did it for me. And it opened nicely, and I saw the airplane flying away with flames coming from her. And
Did you see what happened to her?
I didn't see a crash. I saw her going away. I came out, and I was facing that way, and she went go away to my right.
Now, you'd never parachuted before, I presume?
No. We did parachute drill on the ground, i.e. Prepared to abandon aircraft, and the hatches were open, and we sort of rolled out onto the ground, if you like. And the same with ditching. We used to do ditching drill in the same way.
So the only training was really how to get out
and
a bit about landing?
Yes,
how
we
to
were
land.
Told how to roll land and roll over. Just that, that's all. But instinctively, this is what I did. It's incredible.
What did you see anything else as you went down?
I saw nothing.
Where you were going to?
No idea. It was dark. There was no moon. It was just a starlit night. Very dark, of course. And I did look down. I think I may have got out. We must have dropped about in the dive. We must have lost about 4,000 or 5,000 feet, I would have thought. And we bombed at around 12,000, so I probably bowed out around about 5,000, 6,000 feet. coming down, I looked down and I could see what I thought was water. And I thought, well, it's not. And I knew it wasn't the sea, so it must have been a lake. Maybe I thought it was a lake. So I pressed the gas button on my Bay West and blew my Bay West up. But of course, what it really was a ground breeze blowing crops, standing crops. If you've seen that, if you've been on a stood on a hill and seen the corn or whatever blowing, it looks like water. Anyway, so I was drifting down, facing the way I was drifting, fortunately. And as I got close to the ground, I saw a wall coming up. And I lifted my feet over the wall and landed.
Good landing?
Very good. Copybook landing, even in my state. Brilliant. I thought it was brilliant, quite frankly. And it was in a small back garden, perhaps 15 feet across or thereabouts, maybe less. It was just enough room for me to land and roll over in the approved manner before hitting the other side. So that was that. I instinctively thought of getting away. Because I kept, my conscience kept coming and going, if you like. But I'm still thinking, if I can get away, we're in the Ruhr, so we're close to one of the borders. But of course, there was no chance I was going to do that. I was in a state of collapse, practically. So I undid my harness, took my Mae West off, and I groped around and found my escape kit when I made a feeble attempt to bury it. There was a little baby, a little scraggy bush in the middle of this little garden, and I tried to bury this thing under there.
Now, what was your escape kit?
Well, the escape kit was in a plastic little box. In there was a silk map. There was money, Deutschmarks. There was water purifying tablets and a little bag to put water in, to hold water in. There was a tube of morphine. There was a compass, and I think one or two other bits and pieces that would be helpful if you escaped.
Now, why bury it then? Do you see what I mean? Because that sounds like I've got a bunch of useful things.
No good to me if you're a prisoner of war.
You realised you were going to be captured?
Yeah, because I couldn't do anything. In the state I was in, I couldn't escape. I couldn't evade.
You couldn't move.
Kits were for evasion.
Could you get up? I mean,
no, I couldn't. No, I couldn't. I didn't get up. I was lying there when they found me.
Sorry, I've jumped you ahead there. Yeah. So you bury your escape kit. Best you can.
Well, tried to.
And what happened then?
Well, I was all over the place, lying down, and then I heard the all clear go. My parachute, of course, was hanging over the wall into the street, and I'd made no attempt at all to drag that in.
You couldn't?
I couldn't. So you can tell what state I was in.
And you were in a garden, basically.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So, I thought, well, I didn't think anything really. I was just lying there, and I heard the all clear go. That sort of woke me up a bit. Then I heard people, and then I heard footsteps come round this wall. That was obviously the street side, and then a voice at the back. There was a door that, in fact, at the back of this place. And I've since got a map of that area, and there was a footpath at the side, and that's where this guy, he said, hello, hello, and I called out, hello, in a weak voice, and he came in, and it was a soldier, I suppose he was on leave, and there was a door at the back here, so he came in, and he lifted me to my feet, put his arm around me, took me out of the garden, into the street, and into the house. By now, there were several people, they'd obviously come out of an air raid shelter. There were several people there, and the little lady, her name is, I'll tell you her name, her name was Mrs. Marguerite Franzen, so I was told.
That was her house, was it?
Yeah.
Now, I should have asked, where was this house? You landed in the garden?
This was in a village called Mannheim, 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 a village. So he took me into this house, and it was a little two up, two down cottage, it seemed to me, because the front door opened straight into what was the I suppose, the kitchen, because there was a sink in one corner, little kitchen table in the middle, and they all piled in, these people, and there were three or four children, all looking very worried and apprehensive. And this little lady, she shook her fist at me, but then she sat me down on the chair, got a cup of water, gave it to me, and made signs for me not to drink it, but just to wash my mouth out, because by now they'd opened all my clothing, lifted up my clothing, and seen this hole, which was oozing a bit, and there was a hole about that big.
Well, that's about an inch.
An inch across. Yeah, and it was an absolute hole. And there was a hole similar size in my flying jacket, punched clean through, and through all the rest of my clothing. So all that stuff had been taken into me, all these bits and pieces, by this shrapnel. So that's that, and they're all chatting about it. And then a guy came in.
They were basically treating you well, though.
Yes.
I mean, she may have sworn at you or whatever.
But nevertheless, she did that. It was a reaction, but there was no sort of hatred in her eyes. It was a bit like saying, oh, you naughty boy, if you can imagine. So that was that. They treated me nicely. And then this guy, big guy, came in a black uniform. Wherever you went in Germany, there was somebody in a uniform. And he was waving his big Luger about. And he was, English was fine, he was saying. And he actually said, English was fine, would you believe? And I think he wanted to take me out and pop me off. But
now, who was this? An SS?
Well, I think it was a local Gauleiter or something. Anyway, he was a big guy in a black uniform with a big gun. And anyway, they argued with him, and he cleared off. And he had to stoop. He was so big, he had to stoop to get out of his door. It was a little front door. So he's gone, and then two young chaps came in. They had tin hats on, so I suppose they were railroad wardens doing their bit, as we did over here. And they were also gentle. They had a stretcher with them. They put me on the stretcher gently, took me out and a few yards up the road to a house, put me on the pavement, and that was the local doctor. And he came out. They went, knocked on his door, and he came out. He put a pad on my wound, and he gave me an injection of some sort. And then, I saw these children, I thought I'd my senses about me enough to think, if I do a bit of flannel here, I'll be all right. So I was going to give the children my chocolate, my two bars of chocolate. I thought that'll go down well. But they'd fallen out, unfortunately, when I bailed out, so they were gone. So that was that. So that ploy didn't come off. Anyway, so having put the pad on my wound and given me an injection, he then put me in the back of his car, which was parked outside, and we drove off into the night.